Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Kimberly Voss, a professor at the University of Central Florida.
fantastic. Thank you so much for doing this. And I know, but not everybody may know, where is the University of Central Florida?
It is Orlando, the home of Disney World, in the middle of Florida, the theme parks and all of that.
So, if we can move in around and beyond Disney World today, that would be great. We may avoid Disney. I may be the one obsessively naming it. It may not appear again. But what I'd like to do to start with is to ask you, Prof, if I may, what's currently preoccupying, dynamizing, retarding, interesting you?
In a sad way, is the connection of my research, which is largely the 50s and 60s, still apply today? I kind of hoped we would have moved beyond some of that, particularly politics in the US and specifically in Florida. What interests me is the way that history is expanding. For a very long time, history was defined by presidents and military leaders and maybe a first lady or two. But now we're starting to see the addition of things about communities that weren't covered before, or some of my favorite things, which are food and fashion. And the challenge is trying to justify sometimes these things that are so important that haven't been covered.
And one of the things that you look at a lot in your research is social history,
Yes.
and as an answer to this business of kings and queens and presidents and so on. And in particular, I think it's fair to say, the contribution of women in the US political sphere and especially in journalism.
Yes.
I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the political stuff and the idea of being a polite woman versus a nasty one. And I must ask a first question. Are you a nasty lady or a polite lady, Prof?
I think I fall in the middle.
I think that
I'm from
might be true of
the
a, I think that might be true of a lot of us, don't you?
Yes. I'm from the Midwest, so we're naturally polite. But in looking at the history, there's been a common phrase that is used: well-behaved women don't make history.
Yes.
And I always think that's the fault of the historians, because those stories have not been told. Because the way that we make change, historically and definitely socially, is a matter of a mix of things. There are people who marched, and there were people who worked behind the scenes. And most of the women that I write about, whether they were journalists or people who were covered by journalists, was that they were the well-behaved ladies. So they worked to make change. And I think the thing that I always found amazing about these women is that they knew they'd never be recognized. They fought for change for everyone else, for the next generations. And they would never benefit from that. And for the most part, it's hard to find their names in history, despite the fact that it's very easy to prove if you take the time to look at what they did to make sure that women had rights in the workforce, but also for homemakers.
And getting back to this nasty versus nice woman paradigm, you quote Donald J. Trump referring to Hillary Rodham Clinton as a nasty woman. And you also give some examples, this is in one of your books, of women who were, in a sense, angry in public. And I think Betty Friedan is one of your instances that you give, who was a communist, Marxist, who turned away from the male-dominated left and became a really seminal figure in the women's movement in the 60s in the United States, but presented herself as angry, and that was an important part of her public identity, right? So I guess what you're doing, obviously abjuring those unpleasant words that Trump used, is to look at people who might have felt angry,
yeah,
but decided that behind the scenes work took priority. Is that fair to say, Prof?
Yes. You know, part of that was the climate, you know, particularly prior to the 1970s, where being angry in public had a consequence. That you could be marginalized, and that what you were saying was kind of an outlier. Because the mainstream media, outside of the women's pages, said, oh, everything's fine. Don't worry about it. Everything's fine. Despite the fact that there clearly were angry women, some openly and some behind the scenes. And some of these women who were angry knew they couldn't afford to show that publicly. And so they would kind of encourage high society, often their rich husbands, to help donate to causes or encourage causes, because they really didn't feel like they could do it themselves, but they still got a lot done.
And one of the pioneering things that one has to do in uncovering people who were a bit hidden from the official record is to work out where the heck the information is. Could you tell us a little bit about how you've gone about that?
Sure. And that honestly has been the hardest part of doing social history, particularly about women in journalism, in, say, the 40s, 50s, 60s, a little bit of the early 70s, because there's not really archives that keep most of their papers. But the great thing is about writing about journalists is that when they retire and when they die, they always get long stories in the newspaper. So you can look back at what their colleagues had to say. And so they did get coverage, particularly if they died, you know, in the 80s and 90s, is there actually was all of this information from a women journalist standpoint. But I should also say that women who got covered, who might not normally be part of a formal history, were part of these kinds of obituaries that I looked at, and retirement stories. So, for example, there would be women in a community who stayed in the home, didn't do anything kind of in the public sphere, but they might have had a recipe that they submitted to the newspaper. It mattered to them so much that it ended up in their obituaries. It really was what these women were doing, whether it was important political things or even small recognition of women in their communities, it clearly mattered.
And I gather from reading your work that you also burrowed around in archives all over the United States to find out about these gals. And while they were still alive, you've interviewed some of them as well. Can I ask about the experience of beavering around in archives, looking for stuff and working out what's germane and what's not? And can I ask about the experience of doing oral history as well?
Sure. Going through personal papers in an archive is my favorite thing. It's amazing what people keep. I had in one archive, I found a letter that the women's page editor wrote about how much she enjoyed her her boss flirting with her. This was a married mother of two. So I just, you know, she gave the papers. And so I thought, oh, gosh, you know, that's interesting that that maybe helped define some moment in your life. And so there's a handful of archives that have women's page editors at them. I also lucked out in that food editors and fashion editors went to a lot of conventions and meetings, and those organizations kept the back and forth on that. So I guess what I'm saying is it took extra searching. It wasn't like someone who was already famous and there's a finding guide for their papers and you could easily find it. This was really more like a detective mission. for example, I looked at food editors, and they often evaluated the Pillsbury Bake Off, which is a big thing in America. You say that you won the Pillsbury Bake Off, you know. And so I found those, and that was interesting to find those aspects of it. But it was a different kind of history to be able to tell a story. So you're kind of picking from different places in the hopes of finding out what they were doing when and how and who knew each other. oral histories. That was also hard to find sometimes for the same reasons. But I did get some oral histories, and that was amazing, particularly because I got several oral histories during COVID, which meant that some poor librarian was the only one at work probably sending me out digitized, PDFs of these interviews. And it was amazing, to be able to see what these women thought and what they were doing, in that sort of way. In terms of interviews, I lucked out that I could interview a handful of the women I study. Again, probably not more than eight. And some of them were by email and a few were online. I did one full biography of a woman, and I did get to visit with her several times, who was just amazing. I got to stay with her and her husband at their home, in addition to other interviews with her. And so my oldest son is named for her husband,
Oh.
because these kinds of things, I was a journalist first, but I love being a historian because you don't have to pretend to be objective. These people were amazing, and I feel very lucky to say so. And I've probably written about 350 or 400 women, and I only found one jerk.
Was she the one who liked flirting with her boss or no?
No, she was more fun. The way you can always tell if you look at obituaries that someone wasn't the best person ever is they describe you as prickly.
Ah, yes.
Because typically when you die, everyone's nice about who you once were. Prickly is the key word.
And you said that I think you were a journalist before you were a
Yes.
historian. Could you share with us a little bit about that?
Sure. In order to get into my PhD program, you had to be a full-time journalist for 5 years, which isn't the only reason I was a journalist. I loved it. But I always felt that I had to cover hard news. And by hard news, I mean cops in courts, conflict-related topics, because that somehow made you an important journalist. And this would have been in the 1980s. And so that's really. Even in the 1980s, you felt like covering soft news was somehow lesser. And so when I first became a researcher, I was trying to prove that the women's pages had hard news in them because it felt so important. And I did do that. But I began to realize I don't think I like hard news as much as soft. I like food and fashion and furnishings and family and feature stories. And so it took me a long time to accept that that was as good as, covering hard news. And when I looked at what these women were doing, it was amazing. And I felt very validated as a researcher to go, soft news deserves coverage.
Would you distinguish for us a little bit between that hard and soft distinction?
Sure. So hard news is the stuff that lands on the front pages. There was a fire, there was a car crash, someone's been arrested. There's a little bit of a lack of humanity in those stories. Because you're focusing on that deadline, that thing that happened. And there's some of that in sports, and there's some of that in editorial. But women weren't allowed to write in those sections for decades. I mean, really, until the late 1970s, early 80s, a little bit. And women certainly weren't allowed in management. So they didn't really have a voice in deciding what was news in that sort of way. And so I guess I've kind of bought into that concept in thinking that soft news didn't matter. And again, what they call the four Fs, family, food, furnishings, fashion. And that's treated as if it doesn't matter. And it always occurred to me, isn't that what we care about more than a lot of other things? That's every day, right? You decide what to wear, what you're going to eat, what's in the home you live in, and of course, family. Matters, right? And so that was kind of the when I finally started to realize how much that should matter. It made me want to write more and more about those women.
And can I ask about your experience of gendered relationships in your job as a journalist and whether they were similar to the ones you've experienced in academia or different?
That's a great question. I think academia is well behind journalism. And not that journalism is at the forefront of gender equality either. But I think there was a light shined on what women were doing and what roles they were playing. And even though there's no sense of equality, for example, topics people cover, but I think it's much harder to be a woman in academia than a woman in journalism. I am the first and only full professor in my program in journalism. And in the US, I'm at the second largest university in the country. And there's no pipeline for anyone coming after me. And so I do think there should be more of a discussion in academia, in ways that are similar to what once happened in journalism when people began to recognize, yeah, there's no women covering all these important topics.
And one of the things that you look at least one of your books is the situation for Black women in the United States. I wonder if you could talk about the racial issues in terms of women and journalism.
Oh, another great question. And by the way, the same could be said in the comparison between journalism and academia, that inequality is inherently different being a white woman than being a woman of color. And when it comes to journalism, in at least the time period I study, there were black newspapers in every metropolitan area. And so there's almost an automatic separation of segregation, if you will. And it took a while for newspapers to understand what they needed to do. And so by the time we get to like late 60s, early 1970s, we start to see newspapers hiring black women in ways they hadn't before, because again, most black women were at black newspapers. And while segregation is bad, those newspapers offered great opportunities. In ways that metro papers wouldn't have done so. And by that, it enriched newspapers. There were topics that had never been covered before, conflict and concepts and everyday things that newspapers got covered. The more and more there was the hiring of Black, female journalists. And I would say, even at metro papers, who were mostly white journalists, had be covering things in the Black community before other sections of the newspaper. And in looking at oral histories and looking at letters, these women in the metro papers was on purpose. So they would do things like run something that they knew wasn't really acceptable and then say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know the policy." They clearly knew the policy. But in doing it that way, it changed newspapers and expanded the coverage of news. We're still not where we should be in academia or in newspapers, but I think it's improving.
One of the expressions being used about the diminution of local newspapers in the US, which is dramatic in the last 5 years, is a news desert. I'm wondering what implications the news desert model or paradigm or description may have in terms of diversity, too.
It's almost hard to think about what some communities will look like if they don't have some kind of news coverage. And it doesn't have to be a print newspaper, for example. It could still be a digital publication. But if we have areas where there's nothing being covered, it's hard to even know how to address concepts of diversity, which should be covered, of course, when there's nothing there at all. And I would say this is a part where academia is being somewhat helpful. We're starting to see more and more attention paid to the deserts and whose stories aren't being told all over the place. But just yesterday, one university, the University of South Dakota, in the United States, revived their journalism program. So those things give me hope.
Prof, I wonder if we could go through some particular genres of writing
Sure.
that you've been interested in and have written about. And one is something that I can remember, which is the women's pages. I remember when I was a child and a young adolescent in doctors' and dentists' offices, reading women's magazines and the women's pages in non-specifically women's areas to try to work out what women were like and what girls were like, and what they wanted and didn't want. And I remember, for example, one columnist who had a column that was called Merely Male, in which women would send in cute little snippety stories about how nutty their husbands were, right? And they were never about, in inverted commas, serious political issues. They were about men being illogical and silly, but somehow or other adorable, right? And I'm also old enough to remember things like the women's hour on radio stations and the very gendered nature of daytime TV.
Yeah.
What you write about is, in a sense, the end, the decline of the women's pages in newspapers, as well as their lengthy history, which I think in the US lasts about a century. Is that right?
Yep, more than that. Yep, or about that. Yeah.
About, could you tell us what women's pages were and what happens to them, and whether you're still sad about their decline like I am?
So we go back to the 1880s when we see the women's sections appear in newspapers. This was in the Pulitzer newspapers. And a lot of it initially was the ability to sell ads. So if we write about women and we talk about a recipe, or you talk about, you know, the icebox, or, you know, whatever it might be. So it really started with advertising. But the plus side for women was there was nowhere else in the newspaper they could work. So suddenly the women's pages were an employment issue. And often we talk about early women's employment as, say, librarian, a nurse, a teacher. But women worked at newspapers since the 1880s. Now, again, only in the women's pages. They couldn't work, again, in sports or news and that sort of thing, because women's pages appeared the same time sports pages started to appear. So there was a kind of a parallel that was there. And then the real change for the women's pages occurred during World War II. As men were drafted to go off to war, suddenly women could cover hard news for the first time. And that was a big deal because they had been excluded, you know, for decades. And it changed things. For example, some of the first stories having to do with child abuse came out of that, where there was aspects of women looking at police reports or going to hospitals. And because we didn't have child abuse as a concept in the 1940s, obviously it happened. But it changed when women went back to the women's pages, which was required after World War II. And suddenly the news in the women's pages became much more complex. They had been in the workforce with government mandated childcare, and after the war, they didn't, and now they wanted it back. And so a lot of these concepts are because of World War II and what happened to women. But after the war, in peacetime, women were forced back into the women's sections, but they changed significantly. And they disappeared from newspapers, 1968 through 1975, I would say, were the key years that we saw things change. And the women's pages started to be called lifestyle sections. And kind of the major issue is that men then became the editors under the theory that women would be spread throughout the rest of the newspaper. It was a great theory. It didn't happen in practice. And so a lot of the women's page editors that had done these amazing things for decades were let go, went into public relations, for example. And really, the story of the women's pages is not part of most history books. Journalism historians have focused on the front pages. And so the stories of these women have largely been lost, which is why I wanted to tell their stories.
Pardon me. And Prof, what about this issue of, you mentioned child abuse, but other, in a sense, very much hard news stories. I'm thinking about domestic violence and gendered violence more generally. Do they disappear, or do they make it into hard news as they often are today?
In the early years, and I'm talking about, say, 1960s, it was more discussion of problems of society. 1950s, of course, was much more fitting in and being traditional and not wanting to stand out. The first stories of domestic violence, of rape, of even things like pay inequity that were kind of more specifically aimed at women were only in the women's pages. And I think that was a good thing in some ways, because it was almost always just women who were reading the women's pages. So it was a conversation in a way that they didn't have to write a story going through a government official, for example, who might not have been quite, you know, connected with what was happening. And so a lot of these stories that start out in the women's pages will become stories that politicians will have to cover in later years. But I don't think it would have happened, at least when it did, without the women's pages covering these issues, because the editors and reporters knew that their readership understood this. In fact, there's domestic violence shelters and rape hotlines that started only because the women's pages covered it.
And what about feminism in all of this? You mentioned food, fashion, et cetera, et cetera. What about feminism? It's now almost a century since the Equal Rights, or sorry, just over a century since the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution was first being promulgated. Of course, it's never been passed.
Right.
Could you tell us about whether the women's pages were covering things like the ERA, to use its acronym, and feminism more generally? Is there a sort of shock when feminism, when angry women do start appearing in the right. news, in the hard news? People like Gloria Steinem or Betty Friedan, for example?
I was surprised when I started looking at the content of these sections about how, and again, I'm talking the 40s, 50s, and 60s, how scared the word feminism was. And in retrospect, I shouldn't have been. I taught a class on issues in feminism several years ago, and students were like, oh my gosh, that was a scary word. I was like, it's not, let's look at what it means. We just want equality, you know. But that word still scares people. And I noticed in women's sections, they would write around the word. So they would talk about, you know, equality, for example, or equal pay or the Equal Rights Amendment, but they would do so in a way that readers might not get scared by the word. So it was a way of saying, it's okay to like these things, but it's okay if you want to stay home and be a homemaker. Like, there was kind of a negotiation, if you will, of these concepts. And I would also say that there were women that I looked at who were clearly feminists, if we look at the definition of the word, but they would never have called themselves that.
Go ahead.
And in fact, I even found a story about women who are clearly doing feminist activities. And they were quoted in the story by saying, thank you for not calling me a feminist. It was that scary of a word.
This is like Kant and other writers in his time invoking religion at the beginning of their philosophical treatises so that they could then write in ways that were not religious at all.
Oh, yeah. It was almost kind of like you had to sneak it in.
Yeah.
And that isn't to say that they didn't write about things that were important in a gentle way, for lack of a better expression, because women, for example, wanted to get back in the workforce after they had their children, because many of them, their kids are in school full time and they're 30 years old. That's a lot of your life left. And this was a point in time that universities wouldn't let you go to school part time. So if you wanted to finish your degree and you had your children, you couldn't do it. So those are the kinds of things they wrote about that led to change. But again, it was kind of a gentle way of doing it versus marching, being overtly angry. and so it was this way of kind of balancing out, how do we make change without being, you know, the nasty woman?
And if I can jump into the contemporary and your anecdote about teaching. When you say the students get scared, they act frightened when the F word is raised. Could you give us an idea of the profile of those students and what it is that you think is so enraging or engaging or frightening them.
I think it is that concept of one, if you're going to talk about feminism, you have to address inequity. And that's uncomfortable. In the US, we have, for example, Title IX, which ensures equality in education, often just applied to sports and the mediated world, but it means that you have to be treated equally. The same scholarships, for example. We can't have quotas anymore for the amount of male versus female students accepted into law school or into medical school, which used to happen. And I think because we have a lot of students who have viewed their K through 12 life through high school as already equal, it's a very uncomfortable thing sometimes to get to college and go, wait, it's not really that way in the real world. And I think that is a thing that I understand the uncomfortable aspect of it. And I'd say tied in with that is the fact that the word feminism has been ridiculed or treated as a very negative concept. And I've had students come up after class and say, do you think you're a feminist? I'm like, yeah, I don't think it needs to be that big of a deal. But to them, it was significant to say that they believed in feminism. And again, I think it's been a co-opted word. I sometimes wish we had a better expression that maybe we could put more of a positive aspect or spin to that. Because unfortunately, feminism is a word that creates very negative connotations for many people. And, you know, kind of as you had asked earlier, that is what I think the women I study would be mortified that they had done all of this. And here we stand in a place where equality for women is still something that might be considered negative.
And just to give some context, Title IX refers to the Federal Education Act, although education is constitutionally a state's responsibility and right in the United States. Yes. There's a heck of a lot of federal money that goes into it. And Title IX applies to those universities that get federal funds, which is quite a lot, particularly Research One establishments such as where you work. So the students who are exhibiting this anxiety or this concern or whatever, are they male, female, white, minority, would you say?
When you teach women's studies classes, they're almost always women. So you're speaking to kind of a particular group. And that doesn't mean that they all believe in aspects of women's studies. I've had students that want to debate it. And sometimes that makes class more fun. Mm-hmm. If you can, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
Other than kind of everyone nodding and already believing in what you're talking about. But it is something that I think we still need to talk about. And, you know, we certainly see female gendered stereotypes still exist in the same way that they did before, maybe a little bit more nuanced. But we still see concepts of, you know, a woman striving for something and being called aggressive or too assertive or the B word. And that could have played easy in the 1960s. So it's kind of sad, right? In 2024, there is such a expectation that women act ladylike, that being assertive or aggressive is a negative concept, particularly because I think this is a reason why so many women haven't gone into newspaper management. Because you have to be a strong boss, but also be nice and likable. And that's a hard mix.
And sexuality plays a part in this, the desire to appear straight?
That's a very complicated concept from coming from the women's pages. I think the women's pages got there. Talking about Betty Friedan, for example, she was very much against the discussion of sexual orientation, but she eventually got there. And I think it was very hard for some of these women at the time to defend everything. Mm-hmm. Like they had to pick their space and what they were going to argue about. Mm-hmm. And that caused a real rift when it came to the coverage of things in the women's pages, was the discussion of something that really separated readers. Again, It's taken a long time to get, you know, gay marriage approved, for example. So I don't blame them for not being as progressive or forward thinking, because it's easy to look back in today's lens to what it was like for them. But I will say that I was shocked how often it was discussed and addressed in the women's pages in the 1960s, where it was not discussed in the rest of the paper.
The rest of the paper. And another important issue for today, birth control and abortion.
Yeah, I knowing the women, I feel like I kind of know them now because of oral histories and the things they wrote. They would be mortified about what has happened to Roe v. Wade. The loss of abortion rights, or the severe restrictions, in many states. I live in Florida. It is now 6 weeks, after conception, when again, most women don't know they're pregnant. And those kinds of things, would have mortified these women that fought for so much, and told stories that you wouldn't find in the rest of the newspaper. In part because, other sections were kind of squeamish about talking about anything with women's healthcare. I'm working on a project right now, and the word menopause almost never appeared anywhere in the newspaper except the women's section, and still barely appears today. So there was this kind of idea of not discussing some things in the rest of the paper that I think made it problematic. It's very easy to ignore something you know nothing about.
Let's move on, pardon me, to food and fashion, if we could.
My favorites.
Do you want to start with the F word ashen or the F word oud?
I'll start with food because I went there first.
Okay.
It's fascinating to me, particularly if you want to talk about teaching students. So often history has been defined again by these conflicts, or the things that they've often heard about before, having to do with war and generals and that sort of thing. You talk to a student about food, they love history. They're looking for a different way into history. And so talking about food is a real, to me, interesting way of doing that. Partly, you can look at regions. People in Miami don't eat the same thing as people in Milwaukee. And so it defines a region. So it's very hyper-local, to use a social media term. And it's about their childhood and maybe their families. And so it's such an interesting way to me of looking at history. And it also helps to understand how things have changed or not changed. I found in looking at the food sections of newspapers, bacon has always been in style, and people fall in and out of love with making bread. So you think back to the pandemic when people were suddenly making bread, right? And it's those kinds of things. And one of the great things I kind of learned, in covering the food section, is that these women traveled and socialized, and got to do amazing things that you wouldn't think about if you think about the newspapers and the women's sections as being devoid of women's roles. And then coming into fashion, the same thing comes and goes. The idea of wearing pants was problematic for quite a while, which doesn't seem much when you have students coming to school in pajama pants. But those kinds of things, the mini skirt and the outroar about the mini skirt, and then they had what they called the skirt, and then people got upset because it was too long, or again, versus being too short. And the editors also agreed that animal prints never go out of style.
Now, by the way, just for different audiences, pants means trousers in this
Oh,
case.
thank you. Sorry.
It can mean women's underwear in some
Oh, gotcha.
countries.
Yeah, the number of people that got upset with women in trousers or pants, was really amazing. I mean, this made the New York Times. It was treated as unreligious, the
Wow. By the
clothing
way,
style.
speaking of food, the podcast is just demanding his afternoon tea. And so while we're chatting, I'm moving into the kitchen. The podcat is 50% vegan. He has vegan dried food. But, he's an omnivore, of course. So he he gets wet food that is from other rooms. But it literally, at the moment you started talking about food journalism in response to my question, he emerged from one of his hiding places to say, "Daddy, come on, dude, what's up?" And so one must
That's
serve the
great.
podcast. So, getting back to the food thing, one of the issues with food pages is that they become immensely common and powerful in newspapers and magazines in the United States, and not only in the US, from about the 1980s, I guess. And they become domains that are, from that point, sort of occupied by men more than they have been, I think it's fair to say.
Oh, strongly, yeah.
Yeah. And they shift a bit from being perhaps ordered around recipes to being ordered around food criticism, restaurant reviews, and so on. Is that fair to say, Prof?
Oh, definitely. One of the things that was interesting when it came to food reviews of restaurants was that women food journalists were allowed to cover what they called ethnic restaurants, so Chinese food or
Wonderful.
it's not great, but I think sometimes their stories were more interesting because the men would cover, say, a steak shop. And it's hard to write different stories about steak. There's just not a lot of nuance in a storytelling, versus looking at another culture. And how the female food editors benefited from that is they would tell their managing editors, who are always men, how do I know if it's real Italian food unless you send me to Italy? So they traveled because they had to say, well, how would I know, right? Unless I really visited there. And so, yeah, some of them spent weeks in Europe or Asia. It was fascinating to be able to do that. But in part, it was because only the, again, ethnic is the wrong word, but that's what it was called at the time, was considered unimportant. But the women took advantage of that. And that was one of the greatest things about everything I've looked at. The
Sorry to
women.
interrupt. Which decade are you speaking about, Prof. K, and this one?
This would be the 1950s, 1960s.
Okay,
By
right.
the time we get to the 1970s, more than half of all food editors who were covering restaurants were male. And in more recent years, from a contemporary standpoint, it has become in vogue to write the meanest, nastiest review you can. And those have pretty much all been written by men. I haven't seen one woman that's written it. And I mean, it's great writing, it's funny, it's biting. But I don't know if it helps someone going to a restaurant order what they want. It's almost entertainment versus I think earlier restaurant reviews were about, okay, I'm going to this fancy restaurant. What do I order? Or I'm going to a restaurant with food I'm not used to eating. What do I order? I would say in the more recent years, it's about being mean and funny. And I think it's kind of taken away the importance of what food journalism and restaurant reviewing once was.
What about, in a sense, the, in inverted commas, to use that expression again, hard aspects of food news? I'm thinking about foodborne disease and public health, and I'm thinking about working conditions in abattoirs and animal rights questions.
Yeah, those were taken away from women. Those were considered hard news. So let's say there would be like a government report that said that, we've discovered this about, I don't know, nutrition or, there's a problem with lettuce or whatever it might be. Those became hard news and were taken away from the women. So it was a dynamic that there was some food being covered, but they wouldn't let the women who covered it all the time cover something that came out of government or out of a report from somewhere. And that to me was in some ways the saddest part because these women would sometimes cover food for 20 or 30 years. They knew what they were talking about. I remember there was a story that one woman wrote where she helped you understand how to pronounce the word cholesterol. It was that unique of a concept at the time. So there was some of that, but overall, if there was a news conference, the food editors didn't go, the government editor went.
And perhaps went back to the newsroom and said, I need a quick primer. What the hell was that all about?
Oh, and that happened with fashion all the time. There were times where a male editor would go and be at something, be at an event. Let's say a government official got married, and would have to go to the fashion editor and go, "Can you describe her dress? I don't know what this is." So there was a sense that women had power. It just wasn't reflected in their position or their paycheck. But yeah, when it came to food and fashion, these front page editors or hard news editors often had to go and talk to the women's page folks.
And moving on now to fashion, Prof, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about some of the transformations that have occurred in fashion journalism.
Sure. It was, gosh, about a decade, maybe a little bit more, that the first fashion editor won the Pulitzer Prize, which is our top award for journalism. And she's an amazing writer. And I felt like that was a point when maybe understanding what people wear is more than a frivolous issue, because that's typically what fashion journalism has been described: fluff, frivolous. And just to give you kind of a current example, President Joe Biden recently had a fundraiser a week or two ago. So it was himself, it was former President Barack Obama, and former President Bill Clinton. And it was the first time that former presidents showed up without ties on. I mean, right? I mean, it's a sense of how President John F. Kennedy was the first one not to wear a hat. And they say that it's either, mattering how you look at it, it was the good or bad of that, but we didn't have milliners anymore. It's a little bit more than that, having to do with cars and trains and such. But fashion does reflect a time period, and it reflects places. Milwaukee, which is in Wisconsin and in northern United States, the fashion editor said that women should not be wearing miniskirts in the late 60s. And it wasn't because she had a problem with the fashion. It's just too cold. And it didn't seem practical to wear this tiny skirt when it's cold out. But these things that go in and out of style, people stopped wearing gloves, for example. Gloves were something that was covered constantly in the fashion section, a big part of department stores. And now, it's just not a thing people do. I'm in Florida, which is very hot. When I look at fashion sections from the 50s and 60s, and this is when you didn't have a lot of air conditioning, these women wore hats and gloves, and it was 100 degrees out.
Incredible. And what
I
about,
mean,
I mean,
there were...
most men's clothing is actually bought by women, right?
Yes.
They buy their husband's underpants and hankies and everything. Has there ever been much about men and clothing in the fashion section, or has it been very much attuned to women as customers for themselves?
I would say, talking about male fashion, I'd say maybe 20% of stories in the 50s and 60s were about men's clothes. And part of this was, of course, the 1960s was very casual. And so there was this kind of pushback about, where you wear the hat or if you wear the hat, wearing ties, that sort of thing. Also, hair. Fashion sections had a lot of hairstyles. And so men having long hair in the 60s was a pretty common debate. If that was acceptable or not. Because part of the women's pages, whether it's food, fashion, or advice columns, was about what was acceptable or not. And that's a big part of what the newspaper kind of pushed back about this is okay or it's not okay, and I'm choosing because I want to be different when we have, so many media outlets to be able to look at.
Prof, I want to finish by giving you the opportunity, if I may, throwing back to you to add anything that we haven't touched on, or if it's something we have mentioned but you want to return to, just to take the chance to conclude things with your
Sure.
own statements rather than responding to my queries.
And I love the questions. I think my takeaway from the work I do is the importance of looking at history in a broad sort of way. The women's pages were part of every newspaper in America and in Britain and in Australia and Canada, only because Those are the ones I've read about before. And they mattered. They mattered intensely to the readership. And somehow we have left them out of contemporary history, social history, journalism history. And so we've erased the significance of these women and the work they did, as well as what they did for their readers. I feel like we have this kind of echo chamber of talking about the famous people over and over again, instead of adding the women in particular who made a difference in their communities in all sorts of ways. And somehow we still have not, I think, addressed the work they've done. When I graduated from doc school in 2003, I wrote about women's pages really fast because I was afraid that someone would beat me to it. And I wanted to make sure I got everything published. I have to say, in 2024, I still have not seen much written about women's page journalists. Part of that is because the archives don't always include the women's pages. In fact, the microfiche that we sometimes look at as historians, you go to the library, newspapers didn't always keep the women's section. So it's literally gone unless someone has digitized it in some sort of way. And so I guess my hope is that we begin to pay more attention to the time period post-World War II, where women were really making change and becoming different people that helped our communities and really made a difference for the things that came before. And I guess in closing, my concern is that we spend so much time talking about the suffragettes and talking about the very early years of the Equal Rights Amendment, mm-hmm. the attempts to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, that I hope we can catch up with that.
Professor Kimberly Voss, thank you so much for educating me so thoroughly, both with your published work and thanks to our conversation today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.